Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. I am the host of Cooking Issues, Dave Arnold, here with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Brooklyn, New York. Coming to you every Tuesday from approximately 12 to 12:45, calling all of your cooking-related questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Actually, Nastasha prefers the non-cooking-related questions, right?
I do. I prefer issues.
Yeah, she prefers just straight-up issues, and if you knew her better, you'd see why. Come on now, right? Today's episode is brought to you by the Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscapes. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. That's www.hearstranch.com. Hey, Nastasha, anything interesting happened this week?
Yeah.
What?
I can't.
Oh, you can't divulge?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm intrigued. Do I know this stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I feel like I'm being left hanging.
Over pizza.
I'm gonna. Well, for all of you out there in internet land, I'm gonna get the real skinny when it comes to pizza time. By the way, the payment we get for doing this fabulous show every week is a pizza and a salad, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Anyway, not that's not good enough payment, Jack. Just talking
and
to our engineer.
Dr. Pepper.
Oh, diet.
No, diet.
Regular Dr. Pepper for you. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Here come the questions. From Andrew Cummings. Hi, Dave and Nastasha. I really like all the stuff you do, apart from providing me with tons of ideas. I think he must be from England. Oh, Australia, I guess he said, right? Because he spells tons in the British fashion.
Mm.
Hmm. Reading your articles and listening to your radio show keep my passion for food going. Well, thank you. He's a food technologist. An honorable profession, when done right.
Right.
When done right. Very honorable profession, when done right. He's wondering if I can tell him anything about cinnamon and its gelling effects. A couple of years ago, he was working for a chocolatier at a small boutique store and saw that the liquid components in Panforte, which is a delicious kind of, it's weird kind of candy, dense sweet from Siena. I actually like it. Do you like it?
I don't know it.
You know, it's that really dense, dark with all the nuts and the candy fruit in it. It's got the wafer paper on the bottom and it stays good forever and you slice it into discs, yeah. Into wedges.
Is it like a caramelly?
No, it's not. Imagine like a fruit cake without the cake.
Okay.
Anyway, but it's real dense. Anyway, sorry for interrupting the middle of your question there, Andrew. So he was making some panforte, and the stuff had turned into a thick slime. And he asked his boss about it, and he said it happens whenever he adds a cinnamon. And he looked around on the internet for some explanation as why cinnamon would cause this kind of gelling effect, but could find no academic papers on it. I'm guessing it's probably some polysaccharide similar to what's in gum arabic, but he'd like to know if it can be extracted and used as a future gelling agent. Well, I was not able to find any information on that, although there is a polysaccharide in cinnamon that some nut job has named cinnamon AX polysaccharide that has some sort of BS health benefit or something like that, but it doesn't say anything about its gelling properties. I doubt it's exactly similar to gum arabic, because gum arabic isn't just, it's not a bark phenomenon, it's a sap phenomenon. So gum arabic is a mix of protein, a small amount of protein, and gum sap. Although there could be some residual stuff in the bark, and clearly there are many barks that are used for thickening. For instance, filet powder. Wait, is that the leaves or the bark? I always forget. Anyways, so yeah, yes, obviously there's probably some sort of gelling agent in it. Another thing is panforte is very, very thick and usually uses a boiled sugar component. So it's probably close to gumming up on you anyway. So the addition of anything that's going to absorb water and have any sort of polysaccharide or water binding effect might cause it to gum up. But I'm interested in this. I'm going to ask McGee if I have... McGee! I'm going to ask McGee next time I speak to him if I can remember. An interesting thing is that... cassia, not regular cinnamon, but cassia, has in it coumarin, which is an anticoagulant. So the exact opposite of making things thick, making things thin. Anyway, I was not able to find anything, but I'm going to keep my ears out for that. And anyone else, if you hear anything about it or have had experience, please write in and tell us, because we're interested in that sort of thing. Okay, I'm going to go on to hello from Adam. Adam has a bacon-related question that he hopes we can help him with. You think so?
Baking.
Baking. You think we can help?
Yeah.
I don't know. This is actually a pretty complicated one, so I'm just going to read it straight out. He said, you know, there are plenty of situations where you need to hydrate a dough to work it, but where the gluten formation is the enemy. For instance, pie dough, biscuits, scones, cakes, cookies, etc. To keep the gluten under control, you usually use low-protein flour, avoid overworking, and then add a lot of a fat. And the fat basically is coating the flour particles and preventing the water from forming gluten. Okay. So, and recently he's read about experimenting replacing water in a pastry crust recipe with vodka, since apparently alcohol doesn't have the gluten activating properties that water does, hypothetically producing a crust with even less chewiness than usual. This is true. This is not only for pie crust, this is also for batters. So, I mean, the famous examples in pie crust land would probably be America's Test Kitchen, Chris Kimball's. His show that he's Cook's Illustrated guy, where they have their pastry, their pie crust recipe that includes a good portion of vodka in it, does two things. One, allows you to add more liquid so that you can make it a little more. It's not as flaky. It doesn't come apart in your hands. It volatilizes off and doesn't form a lot of gluten, so it can be rolled without it getting tough. Right. So that's one application. The second famous one is probably Heston Blumenthal's fish and chips batter, where he will add vodka to the batter to prevent sort of gluten formation, to make it stay crisp without it getting tough at all, without the batter getting tough at all, and without having to add a lot of extra, starch binders other than flour to get it to be where he wants. So these are two very well-known applications of alcohol being used as the, well, hydrate's the wrong word because it's not water, but you know what I'm saying, to give the dough some sort of plasticity. So he goes on and he says, it sounds like the holy grail of pastry crust is a dough with no gluten formation whatsoever. I wonder what would happen if you inhibit gluten formation entirely, with the starch still being in granular form. I think you'd still want the granules to be hydrated to some extent, even if they're just swelling and setting together in an extremely delicate array with little intergranule entanglement, so that you're not eating something that's going to turn it to dust when you bite down on it. Well, okay. Zero gluten formation, 100% zero gluten formation is actually quite problematic because it means the dough is extremely hard to work. This is why it's very difficult to work many gluten-free recipes, right? So if you're going to make, people do make pie crust and whatnot exclusively out of things like potato flour and rice flour for gluten-free recipes, but these doughs are typically extremely hard to handle. The same way that non-flour dumpling wrappers are hard to handle. And the way that those are usually solved is that you will pre-boil a portion of your starch so that the starch will entangle itself a little bit to give you a little bit of structure so that you can then form it into a workable dough. So a little bit of gluten formation can be helpful for, or is always helpful usually in formation of dough, not so much in batters. So in batters, it's not as big of a deal. But anyway, so he goes on, and his last thing he's positing, he's saying, a while ago, I was talking about the free soft stability of gelling agents, and this came to mind. What if we had a gel that had poor heat stability so that the gel is holding on to most of the water when you're forming the dough, but when it's heated, the gel loses its hold on the water and allows it to seep into the flour, and that would control the shape of baked goods and make it so that it had a fairly high water content without it having a lot of gluten formation. Well, I'm not sure if that would actually be useful or not, but if you wanted to experiment with it, because in general, like very, very low water formation things still are delicious. The classic example is shortbread, which is basically, you take butter and sugar and a tiny bit of flour and just barely get it to hold together and you bake it. And is there anything more delicious than shortbread?
No.
No? You like it?
I know.
Do you like, you don't like it?
I don't really like it.
You don't like shortbread?
Mm-mm. No.
What?
It's like hardtack.
Are you nuts? Who made your shortbread?
My mom.
Jeez, my God. Shortbread like hardtack? My God. Anyway, I'm sorry for that outburst. All right, listen. We have a caller, but I'm going to tell you, first, try an agar fluid gel if you want to get something that's going to hold onto water, but at the close to the boiling point, will melt out. Kappa carrageenan won't form a fluid gel, so you can't use it, even though it's going to melt at a lower temperature. Hardtack, indeed. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. I love the show, by the way. Lots and lots of useful hints. I have a couple questions about hydrocolloids.
All right.
Specifically, I've been using agar and guar gum together. Sorry, xanthan and guar gum to stabilize emulsions.
Right.
And I was wondering, do you have any tips for making them heat resistant, particularly like a hollandaise or a beurre blanc?
Okay. What guar are you using?
It's just this guar gum on it. I got it from Will Powder.
Okay, I don't know which. Will's a good guy. Taste it. If it has a bad taste to it, it means he's sourcing, and there's no offense to him because I don't know what he's sourcing, but he's sourcing an inexpensive guar. And if that has a beanie taste to it, this is before I answer your question, if it has a beanie kind of off taste to it, you're going to want to call a company called TIC Gums and get theirs, which is called Guar Flavor. It's flavor-free Guar NT2000 or some crap like that, but it's flavor-free Guar. And that stuff's awesome, right? That stuff's really good. Now, Will might be sourcing that. So if you taste his Guar and it tastes okay, then I'd stick with it. But if it does have kind of an off taste to you, then I'd look into getting another guar. Now, what specific problems are you having with stability using that system?
Well, what it is at a reasonable temperature. It's very, very stable, more stable than any Hollandaise or Bourbon I'm making.
Sure.
But I want something that I can pour onto the plate like at the same heat that I would pour like a demi-glace or any other typical hot sauce. But when I get up to those temperatures, you know, like the 60 neighborhood, the guar won't help it, and it just splits eventually.
So even at 60 degrees.
Well, I wasn't being that precise with my measurements because I'm not keeping it in a circulator. I was trying to keep it just in the traditional steam table where you don't have that sort of control. So I was wondering, like, I have methylcellulose. Is there any other products that or combinations or percentages that will increase the heat resistance?
Well, the problem with methylcell is methylcell gels when it gets hot, so it's going to get firm and it's not going to stay pourable. I'm surprised.
Right.
So when you heat guar, what happens is guar loses some of its thickening power. It doesn't get damaged in any way. When it cools down, it will come back to its thickness. But guar loses a bit of its thickness as it gets heated up. Unlike xanthan, which only loses a very little bit of its abilities when it's heated up. Now, I wouldn't want to thicken the guar at all add more guar because A, you're going to start tasting guar, and B, it's going to get too thick when it gets cold. I'm wondering whether the heat, the damage is actually happening to the egg proteins in it, right?
It's like I'm to keep it as more like a traditional Holland. Well, first I was doing Hollandaise, that style, then I tried doing Beurre Blanc, and I had good results with both, but I'm trying to keep that original Hollandaise Beurre Blanc texture, and I thought if I brought my percentages too high, it became a bit too, well, gummy, you know what I mean?
Right.
So I was wondering if, because already I found that doing the xanthan and the guar together made good results. I was wondering if there was a third guy to bring in there that might bring some of that heat resistance without bringing my percentages too high.
Triple gum systems can be difficult because you can have multiple interactions with things. So basically you don't have an emulsifier in there. What the only emulsifier you have are the egg in the one and the milk solids in the other. So both the guar and the xanthan, the guar is acting basically as a thickening agent to prevent the particles from glomming together, and the xanthan is acting as a weak gelling agent when it's not being stirred, right? And so that's basically your stabilization system. You might want to move to an added emulsifier. So a good one in this choice might be gum arabic, right? So instead of using xanthan, we use a mix of gum arabic and xanthan called Ticaloid. They're also from TIC Gums. Ticaloid 310S and Ticaloid 210S, and it's a mix of xanthan and gum arabic. Gum arabic is going to act as your emulsifier, right? And then the xanthan is going to act as your stabilizer and as a weak gelling agent when you're not stirring and sitting on the steam table. I've made butter syrups, just butter syrups with that will sit on your bench or get heated indefinitely without breaking. So then if you're having further problems with breaking, you can add something like guar, or even a starch to something like egg yolk to prevent the egg yolk proteins from being able to coagulate and turn crappy on you. So I would try a system of gum arabic and xanthan, and an easy premix one is a Ticaloid 210 or 310S, which they'll sell to you or sample out to you, or just get commercially available gum arabic and add it into that, because I think what you need is to add an actual emulsifier. And the good news about the gum arabic is it's fairly stable over a wide range of heats, and it's also fairly stable over a wide range of dilution. So if you were to then suddenly use a you could even fortify a liquid into that Beurre Blanc to thin it out a little bit, and it would still hold its sauce consistency. So it acts It's a lot more friendly than a traditional beurre blanc, and it could make you could have like a base there that would be useful for a lot of different recipes.
Right, right, great. So gum arabic definitely sounds like the next thing I need to try. Can I hit you with one more quick one before I go?
Sure.
I heard you talking about gum, like candies just a second ago, and I was actually planning on doing a wedding where I was going to have candies at the end. What product is the best one to use to get that Sour Patch Kids kind of stretchy jellies?
Well, so like the classic American ones, you want an American Sour Patch Kid? Those are gelatin. That's just straight up gelatin.
I was using that. Now it was getting like more kind of solid cuttable before it was getting stretchy. Well, what am I doing wrong?
I haven't. It's been a long time since I've worked with anything like that. I've never gotten really good results. From everything I've read, like the gummy bears are starch molded. And so it's all about getting, that's why they have that poured looking back, because they're molded into starch, right? So it's like, it's all about getting your moisture levels right and just not rushing it. Like those gummy bears take a couple days to make. So they're,
right.
you know what I mean? And so it's all about getting the moisture level right and having them dry at exactly the right rate. That's why gummy bears, they don't last in the bag, right? You could tell if you got an old one because they turn hard, and the young ones that are just right have the right texture. So, I mean, I would look at, you can look in some of the old books, like that one I mentioned a bunch of weeks back. I don't have the name in my head. It's by Kirkland, called Professional Patisserie from like early 1900s, because they have all the cornstarch recipes. But there are some modern books that also talk about that. I don't know whether Tora Blanca's book talks about that, but he talks a lot about cornstarch and molding. And it's interesting stuff. European-based jellies are more based on pectin, but that's more of those fruit slice textures that your teeth sink into, and they're not the same as a gummy bear. Also good, and I think probably easier and faster to make.
Yeah, all right, that's cool. The one other problem I was having is when I coated them with citric acid, I was getting a little bit of bleeding. Do you know anything about that?
What do you mean bleeding? You mean from your tongue after you ate too much?
I guess I hadn't dried them properly, but the other thing was I was doing half citric acid, half sugar, because I didn't want to cut it with pure citric acid. I think it was the sugar, when it contacted the jelly, it started leaching water.
Hmm, that's interesting. It probably just wasn't, I've never done a coating of a candy like that. They probably make the candy first and then spray it with something so they can pan it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm.
So they probably have a,
yeah.
I don't know that for certain. I'm saying that out loud, just saying it, but that's how I would do it. Rather than try to control the powder and the candy making at the same time, but
they toss them in cornstarch or something like that.
Well, they mold them in cornstarch, and then they probably have something that they paint on the pan. I'm not sure what, like maybe an alcohol, and then get it to adhere. But I don't know. I'd have to look into it. But the citric acid shouldn't cause you any problems. But go ahead and get some other acids too. Get malic acid. Get tartaric acid.
All right, well, when I go and find my gum arabic, I'll look for those too as well.
All right, give us a holler. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks a lot, Dave.
All right, bye. We're going on to our first commercial break on Cooking Issues.
Well, I know it's kind of late. I hope I didn't wake you. But what I've got to say can't wait. I know you'd understand. Every time I tried to tell you, the words just came out wrong. So I have to say I love you in a song. Yeah, I know it's kind of strange. Every time I'm near you, I just run out of things to say. I know you'd understand. And every time I try to tell you, the words just came out wrong.
Welcome back to Cooking Issues. So that was Jim Croce. We haven't had Jim Croce as our middle music before, right, Nastasha?
Yeah, we love him.
Yeah, we love Jim Croce because I used to listen to it. My mom, when I was growing up, used to play it all the time.
Me
but
too.
Like, he has this song where he's like, Nastasha and I always joke about this. He has this song where he's like, I know it's kind of late. I hope it didn't wake you. And then he goes on to like have this like crappy love poem where he's like, I hope I just called to say I love you in this song. But like, so Nastasha and I always go through it. We're like, you know, it's the phone's ringing at 3 a.m. You pick it up and you're like,
who died?
Yeah,
who died?
Who died? Oh, Jesus. And he's like, oh, I know it's kind of late. You're like, what? What? Jim's. Snap out of it. Anyway, okay. We have a question from, let's see which one we're going to take next. We have a question from Johnny Hunter in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, I have a couple questions about using Activa RM in dry curing meats. Activa RM, for those of you out there not in the know, is meat glue. The wonderful, wonderful, wonderful product that glues any proteins together. First, does it work to glue two muscles together and then do a dry cure? He was thinking this might be nice as he was trying to do a dry cured ham without the bone. It would allow for better shape and less air pockets, etc. That's true. The way they do a boneless, like a prosciutto, is they actually cure it bone in and then they debone it and they have a very high pressure press that presses it into a ham-shaped mold. That's why all prosciuttos are the same shape, because they've been crushed into that mold. These are the ones that are boneless. Okay, so yes, this would work. This would definitely work. I mean, make sure that you add some, you know, in fact, it might help you because you could salt in that interior portion. And so when you're curing your own ham, a lot of times you'll get taint or lack of cure along the bone line because it's not going in, especially through the fatty areas. And so this would give you an opportunity to get some of the cure on the inside of the meat as long as you didn't oversalt it. And then you could still glue even over a light salting there and you're not going to get a lot of bacterial problems. I mean, the one main problem you're going to have from doing it is you're going to be introducing bacteria into something and then gluing it shut. So you want to make sure that you're killing bacteria right away there. So I would definitely put some nitrates, and some salt. Enough salt to kill whatever ails you on the surface of that, because otherwise you're going to be in deep, deep doo-doo. I don't want you to get anybody sick. Second question on meat glue was about rolling cured bellies. He mentions Thomas Keller's recipe in Under Pressure for rabbit bacon. I was like, rabbit bacon? That's crazy. Rabbit bacon? That's a pain in the butt. Think of how small the belly on a rabbit would be. But he didn't mean that. He meant rabbit with bacon, not bacon made from the bellies of rabbits, because even Keller's not that decadent to like kill 1,000 rabbits for one serving, although maybe he is, I don't know. I mean, I don't really know the guy, so. So basically what Keller does is he layers rabbit up with bacon using Activa, using meat glue, Johnny's tried this with a couple of different animals, including rabbit and goat, and after he cooks the bellies and slice them and roast them in the oven, they come apart. So is there any way to do it such the meat doesn't separate when it's cooked at a high temperature? Thanks a bunch. So here's the problem. I read Thomas Keller's recipe in the book, and it's not apparent how much kind of meat glue you have to add. And he's layering slices of bacon together with like one layer of meat glue. You need to make sure, first of all, when you're gluing things that have a lot of fat, you're not actually gluing the fat. What you're doing is gluing the connective tissue, the collagen, and the different proteins that form the network of the fat before it's rendered, which is why you can't glue rendered fat. You can only glue, what do you call it, native fat? Native fat?
Yes.
Yeah. Basically, if it's rendered, it can't be glued. What you are gluing is the stuff that ends up being a chicharrón if you were to cook it long enough. That's that protein residue. Okay. So you want to make sure that all of it has a thin dusting of meat glue on it. And then even at high temperatures, the stuff won't come apart. If you brutalize it, like you fry it in an oven, sometimes the violence of the frying can make the meat pieces come apart. But the bond itself won't be damaged as long as you have enough meat glue such that connective tissue is always touching connective tissue. So I would make sure that you get both sides of any belly that you were doing. You might even want to switch, instead of using Activa RM, using Activa GS, which uses gelatin as its bonding agent. It's going to be a little bit stronger of a bond, and also you can paint it on to make sure you're not missing anything. Just don't add too much liquid or it's going to be a problem. Keller also recommends an under pressure using a sieve, like a handheld sieve. Don't use that. Use like a cocoa duster, because it's going to get a much finer coating. So you should be able to get it to work if you do it. And on a side note, I had a lot of comments on our blog recently coming from nut job wingding freak shows who are anti-meat glue because of some knee-jerk reaction that they think they're going to the butcher and their butcher is serving them some sort of like hacked up piece of hamburger and selling it to them as a whole steak. And it's all based on some crappy expose, in quotes, because it's not an expose. It's an expose of something that's not happening on a show in Australia called Today Tonight Show. The show itself has an oxymoronic freaking name, Today Tonight. It's a dumb name for a show. Only, you know, I don't understand, like, unless you're a listener, in which case, producers, I love you, I love your show, have me on. Basically, it's saying that, like, some of the quotes that are absurd to anyone who's ever used meat glue before are, even an expert can't tell that something's been glued together with meat glue, and anyone who's ever looked at a piece of meat before in their lives can tell the difference between a bunch of scraps glued together and foisted off as a whole cut of meat and one that's been, you know, that it's a real honest-to-God muscle. So I think they're making a kind of tempest in a teapot about a problem that doesn't really exist, and they're also saying how it's a bacterial nightmare. Well, because when you're using meat glue, one of the things you have to be really careful of is that you're taking and you're putting things that possibly contaminated with bacteria on the inside of your meat, which before you thought was relatively sterile. But the trick with that is it's not that that's unmanageable, it's just knowing that's what you're doing. And anyone who's properly trained using meat glue knows that they have to kill that bacteria that they put on the inside. So I encourage all of the listeners of this to go around, find these blog posts with these morons who think they also say, it's banned in the EU. Well, it's not banned in the EU. Thrombin-based meat glue is banned in the EU, not transglutaminase, which is from an enzyme. Thrombin's a blood clotting factor that's used as was used as a meat glue, is banned in the EU. And it was banned in the EU for dumb reasons. It was banned because the morons who were doing the legislation couldn't think of a valid use for it because they're not cooks. This is another problem of a non-cook. And they saw too much of a problem where you might do something fraudulent. And so they banned the use of that, but didn't ban the use of the other one, which is more prevalent. The thing that makes me really angry about this is that it's so easy to bind together meats with crappy binding agents like carrageenan and like the way they make dog food. Everyone, when they see a bound piece of meat, thinks it's been bound with meat glue. Meat glue is actually an expensive and nice way to bind things together without the use of a lot of fillers and gelling agents, which is how people can rip you off if they really feel like they're going to rip you off anyway. So go out there and smack these people upside the head with some knowledge because they need it. Okay, sorry. Okay. And from Australia, this is from James. Hey guys, greetings from Australia. I'm assuming James is not a member of the Australia Today Tonight show.
Hopefully
not. He's been enjoying the blog for a while, so it's probably not, and getting into the podcast. So he has a question for the show. He's been struggling with oven spring in his bread for 2 years, and he's stumped. So far, I'm going to be him now. So far, I've managed to work my way through every single problem apart from the vexatious side bust out. So when he's cooking it, the oven spring, what's happening is instead of going along where he slices the bread, he's getting a burst in the seam along the bottom of the bread and splitting it on the bottom, which is not what he wants to have happen. And he's tried all the different kinds of things you can try, varying his different hydrations from 60 to 85%, using autolysis, which is a process where you start the mixing of the flour, knead it a little bit, let it rest for a while, and then knead it again, mixing different batters, making different kinds of starters, different kinds of hydration, different kinds of mixing, different kinds of flours, etc., different kinds of salt ratios, different kinds of risings, different proofing levels, different baking, yada, yada, yada. So he's wondering what the heck is going on. And so he says that sometimes he now uses a different steam technique, where it's called steam via ice, where everyone who bakes bread knows that steam formation for many types of bread, steam formation in the very beginning of bread baking is extremely important. And so he's been trying, one of the ways is you throw ice in and it gives you a constant rate of steam because the oven can't melt and evaporate it all quickly enough, so you have a steam that lasts a little while, whereas if you just throw water in, a very well-vented home oven will just obliterate the steam and you're not going to get enough steam. So he wants to know what to do. Well, I was going to say that most times when you get a bad burst in the bottom, it's actually because you're using, you're not doing a good enough forming technique, assuming that everything else is okay. You're not like giving a good skin to it when you're forming it around. But you say you've tried that. So I would go, when I have a question, I don't know whether the baking community respects them, but I like going to the Fresh Loaf, which is a blog, which is pretty interesting. And also there's a kind of a nut, and I appreciate nuts. There's a guy, named Steve B, and I forget what his blog is, but you can find him, Steve B, and he experimented with a lot of crazy stuff, and he found a steamer that is I also forget the name of the company that manufactures the steamer, but basically what you do is you take a hotel pan, you drill a hole in it, you put it over your bread as soon as you put it on your stone, and then you rig up a garment steamer with a nozzle and you pipe steam into the hotel pan for like 20 or 30 seconds and then put it in the oven, and then a couple minutes later take it off, and that more closely mimics the steam that you're going to get out of an oven. And I have never used it, but it looks really interesting, something you might want to try. And there's a couple of people on the web now experimenting with these like handheld steamers and hotel pans, upturned hotel pans. So, I wish it was still wintertime. I mean, it kind of still feels like it.
Yeah.
But I wish it was, because it's hard for me to do a lot of baking because my oven gets like mighty hot, mighty, mighty, mighty hot. In addition, though, I'm curious about like what the actual mechanism of steam is, because it seems kind of confused. People say multiple things that it, like I'm going to have to do more research on the actual... Everyone knows that steam at the beginning helps the crust formation. Everyone. But a lot of the scientific explanation seems kind of bogus, and I started reading some of the documentation this morning, but I didn't have time. So maybe that's something we'll deal with later on a different Who's Eating What's It. All right? Mm-hmm. So why don't we then take our second commercial break? And while we're going to it, why don't you remember to call in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128, Cooking Issues.
Operator, or could you help me place this call? See the number on the matchbook is old and faded. Living in L.A. with my best old ex-friend Ray. Gosh, you said you knew well and sometimes hated. Isn't that the way they say it goes? Well, let's forget all that and give me the number if you can find it so I can call.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Speakeasy every Wednesday at 3 p.m., where host Damon Volte will discuss cocktails, spirits, wine, beer, tea, coffee, and all things in the liquid universe, with guests ranging from bartenders and brewers, alchemists and ambassadors, roasters and regulars, and every expert and enthusiast in between. Learn from some of the world's leading experts in mixology, bar history, distillation, and brewing about how we enjoy imbibing today. Again, that's every Wednesday at 3 p.m., on the Heritage Radio Network.
You know, Jim Croce is visiting hell on that operator. Operator's just trying to do her job. You know, and he's talking about his best old ex-friend, Ray, who, I admit, is a jerk for running away with his woman.
Or maybe the woman ran away with him.
Well, it takes two to tango.
Mm-hmm.
Takes two to tango. Dear old, best old ex-friend, what is it?
Best old ex, yeah.
Man.
And then anyway, he ends up not placing the call.
Yeah, jerk. Anyway, I have good news that I actually did something I said I was going to do, and I ordered an AeroPress coffee, so I can finally say what I personally think about the AeroPress coffee. We've talked about it a million times on the air. It only costs $24.95, so I ordered it on Amazon, and it makes a perfectly fine cup of coffee. I might use it now as my take in my bag coffee maker, but here's what it doesn't make: espresso.
Mm.
That's it. Doesn't make espresso. But on an interesting note, coffee thing, I learned something recently, that there's this thing called Cup of Excellence. Have you heard of this?
No.
Cup of Excellence. So what they do is they get all these people from every different country. Every different country has its own Cup of Excellence. A lot of coffee producing countries, and there's a huge competition where they're cupped again and again and again, and then the winner, and they're all these small lots, are auctioned off, and someone has to buy the whole auction. So for instance, Dallas Brothers, who is one of the sponsors of the museum thing, we did the latte art judging contest, gave me a bag of Rwanda's 2010 Copacama Co-op Cup of Excellence coffee. And it sells for a lot more than regular coffee. It's like $30 a pound green.
Wow.
Green. Wholesale green. It was very, very good. Cup of Excellence. To check it out, go to cupofexcellence.org. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Yes, it's
no?
Interesting.
Moderately interesting? All right. You still have about 25 seconds because I got two more questions to answer. To call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Okay. Colin, good old Colin.
Oh, boy.
What? This is a not. He said specifically, this has been a cuss-free question.
Yeah, but it's also a controversial question.
It is? All right, well, let's read it. No, it's not actually weed. It's seaweed. Nastasha only...
I read the first sentence and then I forward it at 6 a.m. to Dave.
Yes.
That's what happens.
That's what happens. So she's like, oh my God, he's talking about weed. Seaweed. You know, with Colin, nothing is like what it seems.
Uh-huh.
This is Colin speaking. In honor of the upcoming 420 holiday, although 420 is a holiday for me, it's my wife's birthday, but Easter is actually Nastasha's birthday, which is 424.
Like Jesus.
Well, Jesus, when he rose
born,
from the dead.
Yeah. He
reborn.
Yeah,
anyway, so this year, Nastasha gets Easter. I've had Easter on my birthday before. Jen's had Easter on her birthday before. One of those crazy ones. Anyway, Colin has a question that pertains to weed. And of course, is there some sort of cannabis-related holiday?
420 is the... Jack, you know more.
Wow.
So it's not Easter, it's some holiday that that us old fogies aren't familiar with?
It's been around forever.
All right, whatever. Colin has a question about weed. Of course, I'm not really interested in cannabis. Of course you're not. Mm. It's seaweed that catches his fancy. Seaweed's salad is freaking awesome with its al dente crunch and ubiquitous sesame dressing. Since I don't speak Chinese, I guess, or Japanese, I haven't been able to track down good weed to use in a salad. I see the fresh stuff in some Asian groceries, but the sections near the sea cucumbers where nobody bothers labeling stuff in English. A project I've been sitting on for a few years is to try cultivating seaweeds in order to have fresh unlimited supply of weed. I just saw on McGee's On Food and Cooking that says wakame, kombu, and sea lettuce are commonly used in salads. And so he wants to know if I have any tips, what he should look for in market, or what species make a good salad. Any tips on prep? And since I've used saltwater aquarium before or made them, do I have any tips on sourcing and growing some hydroponic weed? Okay. The problem is that a lot of the seaweeds that you use are too big to basically grow in a normal situation. Although things like wakame are, you know, and you know, kelp and all these things are routinely farmed. I mean, that's how they do it. Like, you very rarely get wild anything anymore, but it's just they're so big that it's hard to do. You can gather your own on the coast, which I've done a bunch of times with limited success. Unfortunately, I haven't done any research recently. Back in the day, the book that, you know, that everyone had was called Cooking with Sea Vegetables by Sharon Ann Rhodes. Unfortunately, it's kind of like, and this is nothing against anyone, it's kind of hippy dip, and I'm much more into, like, straight up, you know, killer information and, like, pictures. And this was, looks like it was written in the 70s or 80s, and I've had it probably, you know, since forever, and it's, like, all black and white, and it's not really up to date. Someone needs to tell me if there's an up to date new seaweed book. But how you use a seaweed depends a lot on what. Oh, if you want a good website, it's interesting. The person who made it apparently doesn't want you to find it because it's very hard to find. But it's Seaweeds of the Pacific Northwest by Brianna Gutschmidt, and the website I don't have here the name of it, but she has a pendiva/seaweed or something like that. But she has good pictures of all different seaweeds that you can get in the Pacific Northwest and how they taste because she ate them.
Cool.
Which is pretty cool. So she has a good list. I recommend you go to that. But
pendiva.com/seaweed.
Wow, Jack's the best.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He's on top,
especially because you called him out.
I know.
So rough. It's not right. Coherent. It's not right. So not right. So anyway, I suggest you collect your own. I've done it. Some people suggest against collecting your own because once seaweeds have been ripped off of their rocks, you don't know how long they've been batting around in the ocean, and therefore they might be, I don't know, rotting or something like that. But I've never died so far from collecting wild seaweed. Oh, by the way, going back, one thing you can raise in your aquarium is certain varieties of sea lettuce, green laver. You can raise in an aquarium. It's going to be an expensive proposition, but you should try it. And knowing you, you probably will. So you should probably give that a shot. I think how you treat it depends on what it is. So for instance, even something like kombu, we use it in a salad after we've used it to cure and cook a duck. So like Nils would have this old recipe where he would wrap a duck breast in kombu, because kombu curing that is awesome, right? And then after we cooked it, we'd peel it off and then we'd slice it finely, and then you could eat it and it was really crunchy. Same thing with wakame. If you don't over soak it, right, it's still got a little bit of crunch. You slice it thin and then you can have it as a nice salad. So how you use the seaweed is going to really depend on what state you get it in. You're going to have to refresh it. Usually it's dried, so you're going to have to refresh it. If you get it fresh, I would just, here's what I would do in general. If you see something in that market, just buy the hell out of everything. Just buy every damn thing and then taste it. And then, just try to compare pictures on the internet to what you can find, because there's a relatively few number of ones that are commercially sold. You know, your wakame, hijiki, arame, lavers, noris, different types of kelps. So you should be able to do a mix and match and then remember the characters' names. I remember once I went to Chinatown looking for pig's bladder, which is legal to get in the U.S. And what I did is I went on Google and translated pig's bladder into Mandarin, and then printed the characters out and then drew a picture of a pig with its bladder and then pointed to it. And I think I got my point across because they were laughing their butts off, but they didn't give it to me, apparently, because it's illegal here. All right. So, since we don't appear to get any more calls, our last story for the day will be what we're going to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
We're going to tomorrow Eater.
Really early.
Yeah, it's a little too early for a burger, frankly. But Eater is going to come to my house because I no longer have a kitchen anywhere. We don't have a kitchen in Brooklyn yet, and I don't have a kitchen in the FCI anymore. So since I'm kitchenless, I'll be cooking it at my house, which actually is I have a sweet kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Sweet kitchen. Anyway, So we're supposed to do our version of the Ultimate Burger. Now, the problem is that so many people have done their versions of the Ultimate Burger, right? You have the modernist cuisine version of the Ultimate Burger, which involves a lot of steps. You know, they cook their burger for a long time. I'm not a fan of cooking a hamburger for as long as they are. I'm not saying I'm not a fan, but it's not for me, because like certain types of meat can take on a kind of gamey livery note that I don't really, that's not for me in a burger. Like for me, like the longest I'm going to want to cook a burger is probably about 4 hours. That's about it. Not tomorrow, because I'm not waking up that early to cook a burger anyway. So like, you know, I also don't like vacuum packing burgers down, because I think they get too kind of smashed. So I'm a fan, the way I like to do it is to take the meat mixture, give it a quick fry to set it, and then put it, I'm going to grind bacon into it though.
Okay.
It's delicious, right?
Sounds good.
I was thinking I was going to use a combination of short rib, chuck, and bacon, right? Grind it. I like a real loose pack and relatively thick, and then fried quickly just to keep the surface intact. Then I'm going to put it into probably butter, or maybe like a butter that's been mounted almost like a beurre blanc with some hyper reduced beef stock. I haven't decided yet. And then, because my wife, right, my wife's birthday tomorrow, so I really shouldn't be doing this. It's my wife's
because
birthday.
Because you already did this.
I already ruined
on her birthday.
Yeah, but listen, she's not going to be there. It's going to be in the morning. My wife is flying to Boston tomorrow, so I have all day to fix whatever I do, right?
To get a new place.
I'm not going to get it. Come on. The place is fireproof. Anyways, because this is the best way to finish a burger off, right? I'm going to cook it in butter in a bag at about 55 degrees for a couple of hours. I'm going to pull this sucker out. And then I'm going to build a small bed of hardwood coals on the inside of my house under my hood in the mini Weber that I have. I'm going to build the temperature up till it's about the temperature of the surface of the sun, such that it's basically melting the Weber into my stove.
I thought that's my Weber.
Well, I let you have it. You never took it home. I bought it and was never reimbursed for it. So, yes, I gave it to you, and I'm going to use it one more time before you take it. You've had a year and a half or more to take it to your house, and you never have. I've moved it like three times.
Cooking issues.
Yeah, yes, you definitely have cooking issues. So anyway, I'm going to fire it up in my house, and I'm going to grill, like hyper-grill it, basically on the surface of the coal to put a nice crust on it. And then I'm going to do my favorite bun. And here's my favorite bun. It's a...
sesame?
No, close. Beef on weck style from Buffalo. It's going to be caraway seed and salt on English muffin, homemade English muffin, and I think just regular cheese.
What, like American cheese?
Something. I don't know. Maybe Gruyere. You like Gruyere?
Mm-hmm.
I think Gruyere. And then I'm probably like the modernist cuisine do a really cool thing where they take and they flash infuse a tomato with like a vinaigrette or something like that, which is a really good idea. But since it's not tomato season, I can't get a decent tomato. I might just use pickled green tomatoes.
Mm.
Do the pickle and the tomato at the same time. Mm-hmm. I like fresh onion, so I'm going to put some fresh onion on it. Nastasha, give me the stink face.
I like grilled onions.
Grilled onions, but
because I have a freaking grill there.
But this is a matter of personal opinion. We can grill some onions for you, but to me, a grilled onion is in between. It's not a sautéed onion, and it's not it's this in between crap.
Raw onions give me nightmares.
What do you mean? Like really?
Mm-hmm.
Like how so? Why?
I don't know. My mom told me.
Well. Wow. Okay. Well, I'm going to leave everyone out there with the image of Nastasha having onion nightmares. And come back next week for Cooking Issues, where hopefully we can discuss some of these onion nightmares. Cooking Issues!
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaway's Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the green market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.